This is Seattle's Morning News. Let's meet the new head of the Washington Education Association, Larry Delaney. You're a math teacher, huh?
That's correct, Dave. Last June, I was cleaning out my classroom.
Why would you want this job?
You know, there's an opportunity as the president of the Washington Education Association to impact the lives of millions of students and 90,000 educators.
So are teachers finally being paid fairly?
Yes. We fought long and hard for fair compensation, professional compensation for educators across the state. And there's probably some pockets out there around the state that didn't make the gains that a lot
but you're
of
generally happy.
Generally happy.
You know,
we are in a much better place.
As a
now.
Union president, are you allowed to be happy with the salaries your
Absolutely.
People are making?
Absolutely, we can be happy. We're in a much better place than we were 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 1 year ago. And there's going to be cost of living adjustments that have to occur. But with that, we believe that we have the ability now to recruit and retain the best educators.
So I've seen pay schedules where the teachers top out after 10 years at over $100,000.
That's correct. Yeah.
That sounds pretty good. And I know one of the perennial complaints of the union has been how in a market where you're competing with Microsoft and Google and Facebook for the talent, how do you get someone to go into teaching if you're topping out at, 60 or 70?
No, you're spot on. In this market in particular, we have to have competitive pay, and we're there. As I said, not all locals are there right now. There's some pockets around the state that still have work to do. We have a lot of work to do with our classified professionals, our ESPs, but we're in a much better place than we were.
Now, we've gone through several attempts to make education more rigorous, including standardized tests. You don't like the standardized test, do you?
No. Standardized tests, when we force educators to teach to a test, some arbitrary standards, that really hamstrings, and we lose the richness of education.
So I've lost touch. Last time I covered this issue in depth, we had the WASL. I think that's long gone.
Oh, WASL to HESPE to EOCs.
So what do you have now? Are there any exit tests?
There are multiple pathways. The Smarter Balance Assessment is still
one. Smarter Balance Assessment?
Smarter Balance Assessment. But we're in a better place right now in public education in Washington because now we provide multiple pathways for students to exit.
So you have
standardized assessment is simply one of those
pathways. So you do have a test still?
There is a test, but it is one pathway that students can access to.
And what are the other pathways?
Oh, there is AP testing, IB testing. You can take the SAT as an example. There is
IB being the International Baccalaureate.
Yeah. And those are designed for college-bound students, obviously. But one of the concerns that we do have with this current model is that there's multiple pathways for high achieving students, college bound students. We still need to work on providing more pathways for students who might not be as high achieving or might not be college bound.
Well, you used to call vocational students?
Well, could call them vocational students. But if we look at, for example, if we offered work study as a pathway, that would be.
You're okay with that? Because my recollection, and I admit it's foggy because I've been around a long time, was that once upon a time, every child had to go to college.
That is definitely once upon a time. There are pathways to the workplace. Now, we would believe that every child should continue their education after school. I mean, that is important. Yeah. And we want to provide the basic education that allows each child, each student, to figure out where their strengths lie and pursue that after school. For some students, that's going to be college. For some students, that's going to be immediately into the workforce. Might be the military. For others, trade schools.
Open to all possibilities now.
Absolutely.
What will you campaign for then? How do you plan to put your mark on the union?
I don't know if it's necessarily campaigning as much as it is having conversations with stakeholders around racial justice, social justice, equity. We believe strongly that a student entering public school right now is a kindergartner. My wife is a kindergarten teacher. Mm-hmm. By the time that student graduates from high school, it's important that they have educators that look like them. We have a student population that's about 50% students of color. Our educators are roughly 15% people of color. And that's an issue that we have to look at addressing. And there's not a short-term fix to that. It involves working to recruit the best educators that we can find and being intentional when we look at our changing demographics in this state.
The salary should certainly help with that.
Oh, right? Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's something that we fully expect.
I know a few teachers and are quite close friends, and one of the things that I envy of them is that regardless of all the years of low pay, they can walk down the street and there will be people who remember the third grade and the fourth grade and the sixth grade who go on to become entrepreneurs, and they can claim to have helped shape those adults.
You know, I've been in this profession now for 27 years, and this is my first year completely out of the classroom. And I have those same experiences. It's interesting when you run into people who are now 40 years old, and they still refer to me. They'll say, "Hi, Mr. Delaney," and that's so odd. And say, "Well, you can call me Larry. That's okay." And then, "Oh, no, I can't. You'll always be Mr. Delaney."
Larry Delaney, who is the new president of the Washington Education Association. Larry, thank you.
Thank you.
Here he is, our resident historian, Felix Spinell. Every Friday, he's all over the map, giving us a quick thumbnail sketch of why places are called the things that they are. And today, a neighborhood near the Vancouver, BC airport. It's a reminder that Canada and Boeing entered World War II much earlier than the rest of the United States, 80 years ago this week, Felix.
Yeah, this is about a place called Burkeville. We'll get to that in a moment. And a lot of Americans still don't realize World War II didn't begin on December 7, 1941. It actually began September 1st, 1939 in Poland when the Nazis invaded, began September 3rd in England when Prime Minister Chamberlain said that Hitler had refused his request to back out of Poland. So much closer to home, it actually began officially on Sunday, September 10th, when King George VI approved Canada's declaration of war against Germany. And CBC Vancouver did a really cool story earlier this week with all these great now and then pictures of World War II in Vancouver. I wanted to talk about a few of the spots. I didn't know that from 1939 to 1945, there was a Boeing factory at the Vancouver airport. This is on the Fraser River Delta, big piece of land called Sea Island, officially in the city of Richmond. So Boeing Canada built an amphibious aircraft there called the Catalina, which was a patrol boat, or a PBY. These aircraft were called Cansos when they were in Canadian service. And later in the war, that plant actually built fuselage sections of the B-29 Superfortress and shipped them down here to Renton for assembly. I thought that was a Dreamliner thing. I didn't know they were doing that 75 years ago, which is pretty cool. So there's part of that factory still remaining. It's a hangar now being used by Harbor Air. And then next to the factory, they needed wartime housing because it was scarce, so they built something called Burkeville, 300 cottages that were for Boeing workers and their families. And it's still there. It still looks exactly the way it did. The streets are named after bombers and airplane manufacturers.
Really?
There's Catalina Crescent, Lancaster Crescent, of course, Boeing Avenue. It's also looks relatively unchanged, too. We have some great photos at My Northwest. And there's one more really cool World War II artifact. I had no idea. You know that Museum of Anthropology out there at UBC, Kitsilano, with the famous totem poles and everything?
Yeah.
So that was built atop the concrete remnants of a World War II-era defense installation called the Point Grey Battery, almost like Fort Casey down on Whidbey Island,
but a little bit
later, like 1939. There was so much concrete and so much there that it was easier to leave it in place and build the museum on top of that. And in fact, there's a really famous sculpture by the guy Bill Reed, very famous artist, called Raven and the First Men. It's on this big circular plinth, which you'd think was built for it. It actually was built for a piece of artillery. It's crazy. I mean, the concrete was so thick.
Oh,
it was
just
cheaper and smart way to reuse it. And I've been there many times. I had no idea. And apparently down below the statue, there's still all the old elevator equipment for the ammunition and everything. It's just, and there's tunnels connecting these three different
plinths. Just in case, you never know.
Yeah. Yeah. It could be reconverted if there was a threat posed by that something. One last thing. We were huge. Cairo and Victoria, we were very popular during World War II because our signal had boosted to 50,000 watts.
Mm-hmm.
Cairo listeners raised money that a Canadian guy from Victoria took to an orphanage in Canada or in London before the U.S. was in World War II. So we're very directly tied to Canada. Cairo is, and this community is, and Boeing is too. And I had no idea.
That's right. And Burkeville still inhabited?
Yeah, it's still there. It's right next to the airport. All these little cottages.
Everybody agrees to keep their house in the original style?
You know, I'm not sure about that, but I think there were maybe three or four designs. It looks like they're all kind of sprinkled around these different crescents and avenues and Boeing Avenue. And it's just this wonderful little throwback. Next time I go to Canada, I'm going to head right for Burkeville. That's going to be my destination.
Felix Spinell all over the map, and all his features are at MyNorthwest.com. Have a good weekend, Felix.
You too, Dave.
Hannah Scott is here. We're going to get up there on the prolific offender issue. Seattle and King County leaders have a series of proposals now, Hannah?
Yes, they were announced yesterday. This is all part of the upcoming budget process for both the county and the city. We heard about prolific offenders, of course, back in February. There was the controversial system failure report, basically highlighting people who arrested the most in the city and the county. And what was found in that study, generally, that these folks are on a catch and release cycle, being arrested for the same kind of low level misdemeanors in most cases, and then quickly released and usually dealing with homelessness, mental health issues, drug addiction, things like that. Well, weeks after that report came out, Mayor Durkan put a work group together with city and county leaders, law enforcement, judges, prosecutors, and others to figure out what could be done here at the local level, and we got that announcement yesterday.
After months of hard work and collaboration, today I can announce that that group has developed four new pilot programs to address the challenge of repeat offenders in our region and to provide both accountability and support to the individuals to disrupt this cycle.
The proposals include enhanced probation, hiring a reentry planner at the jail dedicated to helping these offenders get services and into shelter when they are released, a coordinator at the city attorney's office to kind of oversee all of this amongst all the programs to ensure everything is working, and a new 60-bed enhanced shelter at the King County Jail that offers case management services. But County Executive Dow Constantine wanted to make this point.
Let me be clear. This is not creating some kind of minimum security detention facility. This is an enhanced shelter with 24-hour services. No one is going to be compelled or forced to reside there.
And he said the rapid reentry person at the jail will also help, because right now it's only they have some limited planning going on to help those who are being released, but it's only if you're in the jail for 72 hours or longer. Most of these folks we're talking about are in and out within like 12 to 48 hours. So they don't get any planning. So this person would be dedicated to getting with that person, making sure that they know how they can go get some shelter or get some services of some kind. Kind of the same idea with probation. It would be a very focused probation, specializing, having each probation counselor specialize with these type of offenders to really make sure, because the gap here is that these folks get released and they don't ever get right. hooked up with services. They tend not to finish or comply with their probation requirements. Those folks, the regular probation officers are full up, right? So having these dedicated caseworkers, probation counselors, really checking in with these folks regularly to kind of make sure they're doing what they're supposed to is supposed to fill that gap.
And using the jail space for this sounds like what Judge Ed McKenna, the municipal court judge who was differed, let's say, with the city on whether these guys should get sentences or not. That's what he was proposing. Use that space to essentially provide what? Sort of voluntary
detention. So that's the key here, because it is voluntary.
Yeah.
And there's already criticism that I'm hearing that it's not something where you force these folks to go in. That is something, again, the probation folks who are going to be a part of this can kind of offer treatment facility get shorter time, you know, in jail.
You might as well try voluntary first. I mean, if it doesn't work, I guess you can take the next step. But so the idea is if you have no place to go then, you can't go, then you can live there rent free.
Yes, and it's an enhanced shelter. You can bring your things. You can store your things. There's case management there. It's the you know, what we hear works so well with the homeless populations throughout. So that is what the idea is there. And both Dale Constantine and Mayor Durkan said down the line they might be willing to look at something that's kind of in the middle between not quite a jail, not quite a voluntary shelter to try to kind of compel
people. So what does the city attorney think about this? Pete Holmes, I mean, he's the guy who's sort of been criticized for going too easily on these people.
He's on board. He was there yesterday at the press conference, and he likes all of these ideas, and he says he understands their frustrations, but their bottom line is?
Simply going with an incarceration model is not going to cure the high rates that we're seeing. That is appropriate for certain population members, but it's not going to solve the problems that we see on a larger scale on our streets. Instead, that we're going to apply data-driven strategies and try to deal with these problems together. These are problems, I want to add, that are faced by every city across the country. No jurisdiction in the United States has solved crime, and all have repeat offenders.
And we also had the King County prosecutor there, Dan Satterberg, and he stressed, look, we can only do what we can do, and here's why.
The frustration that we feel has to come with the cost, and that cost has to be to invest in the things that we know can continue to provide stabilizing services to people who need it. Things like the law enforcement assisted diversion program, like the VITAL program, which is a way to anticipate people who are frequently utilizers of the jail, work upstream with them so that they don't come back to the jail. But it's capped at 60 people, and it's full. The involuntary treatment courts that we use, their capacity is way over. It is no longer a credible option.
That is what's leading to the
chaos. When does all this start?
This should be rolling out by the end of this year into next year, as long as the King and Seattle City Councils both approve this. This is all budgetary stuff. But I think that's expected to happen. Really want to stress what he just said there, that this does nothing to help with those folks who are can't get into Western State because they can't be restored their competency and things like that. Right. This doesn't address that. Also, quickly, the Downtown Seattle Association was there yesterday. They're the ones, of course, who were behind that system failure report. They said they like these steps. These are great. It's a nice first step. They want to make sure that those repeat offenders are the ones getting into that shelter, that new shelter. Mm-hmm. But they'd like to see some more done. But they'll be keeping an eye on it.
Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Daily dose of kindness. Now, it's about a 6-year-old South Carolina boy. He's been saving his money for a trip to Disney World on his 7th birthday, which was on September 8th. But Hurricane Dorian forced evacuations near him. So what he did instead is he turned his birthday cash for he turned it in for hot dogs, chips, and water. And he set up along a road, and he wanted to hand it all out to evacuees.
I wanted to be generous and live to give.
It's a simple reason why he did it.
The people that are traveling to go to other places, I wanted them to have some food to eat so they can enjoy the ride to the place that they're going to stay at.
Turned in his birthday money to do it. WJBF featured the boy in a story, and on his 7th birthday, he spent it at home instead because he turned in all his cash. And Disney World happened to hear about that generosity, of course. Paid him a visit at his home with a belated birthday gift.
I heard that your original plan was to spend your birthday at Walt Disney World. As a gift to you, we want you to come enjoy a getaway at the Walt Disney World Resort later this month.
He didn't say much during that surprise, just had his jaw dropped. His mother, though, she had something to say.
The small things you do, you think people don't notice, but to have everyone watching him and telling him, you know, what a good job you've done, young man, I think that really instills in him.
Live to give is his motto. It can be yours now, too.
It's time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, Danny O'Neill. Here's one thing having nothing to do with the upcoming game, but Jadeveon Clowney really wanted the number 90 because I guess he has a history with it, but Jaron Reed already had it, so Jaron gave it up, but Jadeveon had to pay him for it?
Yes.
Is that customary?
It's not unusual. It depends. Sometimes a younger player, there is a very, very strict seniority tier, and sometimes it relates to how long they've been with the team. And sometimes it relates, and also how long they've been within the league. There have been a couple of these. Rasheem Green is a second-year defensive lineman. He was wearing number 94. Ziggy Ansah, who they signed, wanted that number. So when a guy gives up his number, it's customary to give him a little something.
Well, I want to know
how much for the effort.
How much money would we be talking about here?
Jaron Reed's worn that number back when he was in college at Alabama. I think it's possible that we're talking about a six-figure transaction.
What?
Whoa. I was going to say maybe thousands, but I wasn't thinking hundreds of thousands.
I think it's possible.
Seriously?
I think it's possible. It would not be unprecedented for that. That the guy depends on how much. That number means something to Jaron Reed, too. So Jadeveon Clowney's been in the league longer, and so he would approach him and say, hey, what would you think about giving this up? And then, I mean, maybe Jaron Reed, maybe the price tag was lower. Maybe. I don't know how much it meant to him. The fact that he wore it in college, though.
What's the psychology behind the note? Is it superstition like in baseball, or is it just sort of personal memories? Is it a good luck charm?
It depends. Ray Allen, when he was traded and came to Seattle, there was a rookie that was wearing his number, Reggie Evans. I guess it was Reggie was in his second year at that point, maybe third season. And what Ray said is, man, 34, that number has meant a lot to me and my family. Mm-hmm. It's been a business, essentially, that I've built around the number. So yeah, he wanted the number, and gave a significant amount of compensation.
Well, what if you're a defensive lineman, but your lucky number is 3?
Oh yeah, you're screwed.
You're
then.
Never going to get it.
No, because it's Russell Wilson. And they also the NFL in the inflexibility, like it dictates which numbers, like wide receivers
exactly.
can be in the teens or the 80s.
Right. Yeah.
Like so, if your favorite number is 21, or you want to wear number 1, tough luck. Brian Bosworth, when he came here, wanted to wear 44 and actually sued the NFL over wearing 44, saying, I built a company called Blues 44, so I should be able to wear the number 44, but linebackers can't wear numbers in
this
the 40s.
Is...
Why,
yeah.
why do you have to have numbers? Why can't you have letters like a license plate?
or vanity jerseys.
We
you know,
clearly to the numerical system.
I see. Okay, let's talk about the game. They are the Steelers. We're going to be the Steelers. They lost horribly last week.
They've still got Big Ben. There's a lot of expectation in Pittsburgh. The last two times Seattle's been there, also playing in week two, by the way, Seattle didn't score a point.
Huh?
Shut out in each of those games, 2007 and 2011. Didn't score a single point.
Well, consider the squeaker we just had. Are we worried about their performance in Pittsburgh this weekend?
Yeah.
Really?
Everybody should be.
Oh, no.
They throw the ball all over the place. Like, Big Ben loves to chuck it. Last time he faced the Seahawks, threw for 456 yards, which was ridiculous.
Now, Roethlisberger, I mean, how tall is he? 6'4 or something?
Yeah, and he's a big galoot.
So, and that's what I keep hearing. So, are you allowed to just do a flying tackle on him to knock him down or quarterback?
Can't hit him in the head.
Well, no, I wouldn't hit anybody in the head.
Well, in football, you should. It's the quickest way to tackle someone.
I know, but could you do
he's
like.
He's not supposed to do it anymore.
What are the restrictions on tackling a guy that big?
You can't hit him low and you can't hit him high. So you just have to hit him really hard in the chest.
So you could do a flying tackle in the chest and knock him down.
Yes.
And sack him.
Yeah, you also can't kick him. They don't let you kick him just because he's big.
Don't need to kick him.
Well, it'd help. The guy's huge. Have you seen him? He'd be able to chop down a big tree. Big tree goes boom.
So who's the best one to tackle him on our team?
Jadeveon Clowney.
Okay.
Plus he's got number 90. He's ready to go.
All right, Jadeveon. Let's do it.
Yeah.
You just paid $100,000.
Put a whooping on him.
For a shirt.
Yeah. Let's go.
Let's use it. Yeah. What's the score going to be?
I think it's going to be Steelers 27, Seahawks 20.
No.
Whoa.
Come on.
Based on what?
Where's your team spirit?
Based on my hunch, my intuition.
I know.
This was the game that I picked as most likely for Seattle to lose when the season started.
Well, I hope they prove you wrong.
I hope so, too. That'd be great. They're on the road. They definitely don't do well in road openers under Pete Carroll. They've only won one of them. Pittsburgh's at home. They're coming off of a brutal showing. And I think that this is going to be, I fear
Sierra
a long afternoon.
With 10 and 6.
I feel a long afternoon.
This is going to be one of the six.
This will be one of the six, yes.
Hey, thanks for depressing us.
Yeah, sorry about that. Well, maybe somebody will kick Ben Roethlisberger and everything will change.
Danny O'Neill from 710 ESPN Seattle. As you might have heard, there is a brand new antitrust investigation opening against Google, and there are ongoing investigations into Facebook and Apple and, of course, Amazon. So I thought we'd bring in an antitrust expert, Professor John Kirkwood of the Seattle University School of Law. We're familiar with the various privacy investigations, but I wanted to know if this is along the lines of what the government did to AT&T back in the day.
That was a settlement, but it resulted in the breakup of AT&T, separating its long line division from its local services, correct?
Yes, and now 1,000 flowers have bloomed, and we have more opportunities to call each other than ever. But AT&T was, I mean, that was a classic monopoly. It's only one phone company for a long time. I know most people don't remember that these days. Whereas Google, I mean, it is big, but there are other search engines, right?
Yes, there are other search engines. It is the leading search engine, probably the dominant search engine, but it's not clear, as your question suggests, it's not clear that they have monopoly power.
So, how strong is the case against Google, and what could be the outcome?
Okay, well, let's back up and talk about the principal allegation against Google. That allegation is that Google biases its search results. Mm-hmm. So, when someone searches for restaurants or a particular shopping item, Google puts its own service first, the claim is, as opposed to independent services like Yelp or other price shopping services. The FTC looked at this very allegation a few years ago and concluded there was not a case to be made. In contrast, the European Union fined Google several billion dollars for biasing its search results. But in the United States, as your question suggests, the government would have to show that this bias led to monopoly power, and that's harder.
Do you think any of these cases are going to succeed?
That's the big question these days. It's not clear that any will. They all face a variety of obstacles. After all, the government hasn't brought any case against the big high-tech firms, even though they've been big for a number of years. Antitrust, generally, not with respect to high tech, but antitrust generally has been too weak for a number of years. They've allowed mergers that have resulted in higher prices. So it's pretty clear that we need to strengthen antitrust enforcement generally. We're also at a juncture where we have these giant firms, and the question is how to deal with them. An actual traditional antitrust case against them appears challenging for the reasons we've already discussed. And then the question is, well, should we move beyond existing antitrust law and enact new legislation of the kind that Senator Warren has proposed that would require them to separate their own products from their platform? And that's highly controversial. You can see downsides to that. So that's where we are.
A lot of the people listening, of course, work for Apple and Facebook and Google and, of course, Amazon right here in town. If there were some kind of breakup of any of these companies, what happens to their jobs?
Well, I think it's important for them and for all of us to realize that no one is thinking of breaking up any of these firms into two or more versions of themselves. What people are proposing is the separation of products Amazon makes from its platform, or products that Google offers. If it happens in the short run, everyone will keep their jobs. We'll just spin them off as independent companies, and they could succeed.
Oh, well, then no problem.
Well, the problem is whether by forcing even this limited breakup, you deprive consumers of benefits in the short run. For example, if Amazon can't sell Amazon Basics, that has to be spun off into a separate company. Is that separate company going to be as good as Amazon?
Yeah. Professor John Kirkwood, Seattle University School of Law, antitrust expert. Professor, thank you.
You're welcome.
And our whole conversation is up as a Ross Files podcast right now, which you can find at mynorthwest.com, so you can become the smartest person on your block when it comes to antitrust law. And who doesn't want to be in that position? The go-to person at the party when antitrust law comes up. So I heard that Kirkwood interview on the Ross Files.
That sounds like your kind of party, Dave.
It does, doesn't it?
A little bit of root beer, antitrust talk.
Antitrust talk, that's right. A little particle physics, and then near after the races. Seattle's Morning News. How do you establish a good habit, and how do you break a bad one? It is time to Ask Allie with licensed mental health counselor Allie Sokolow, sponsored by ProClub, the Northwest Premier Center for Health and Wellness. Can you just wake up one morning and say, I'm going to stop smoking?
You sure can. It's about how motivated you are to do something and what you're willing to give up to do it.
So how do I know whether I have the motivation, whether I can muster the motivation on my own, or whether I need help?
I think the first question to ask yourself is, what's preventing you from not doing it thus far? My favorite example to use is, I want to get up every morning and exercise. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what is holding me back from doing that? Well, mostly people wake up tired. And so what do we need to change to make sure that we can get up on time to exercise and not feel exhausted? Probably the thing you need to do is change your bedtime. That's called a keystone habit. It's the habit you need to change to make sure you get to the goal.
So changing one habit might involve changing another.
Absolutely. Most habits that we have not changed up to this point is because it's depending on another habit we need to change.
Now, at some point, you have to decide whether it's working or it isn't, right?
I agree.
Tell me how that goes.
So I think that if I have somebody in my office and they've tried multiple times to try and change something, there is something blocking them from that change. And that may mean that there's not a lot of things that they are looking forward to when they reach that goal, or they've put too much pressure on themselves to reach that goal. So for example, like if I lose weight, I'm going to start dating, I'm going to start getting promotions at work, things like that. Well, sometimes that's really scary. That's not exactly something to look forward to. And so there's a mental block around losing weight.
So what can you do, or what can any counselor do, to get somebody past that roadblock?
So we can talk about taking pressure off about what that looks like and looking at everyday lifestyle and what's realistic and what's not. And so if somebody says, I need to go to bed by X time to get up to work out, to lose weight, okay, let's talk about that. Is that really realistic from going to bed at 1 a.m. to all the way back to 10 p.m.? Or can we start going back in half-hour increments so you can, your body can get used to going to bed earlier? Maybe your goals are too extreme, and so we need to break them down into smaller goals so that they're achievable. Because I think people get frustrated and they say, okay, I've tried this so many times and it's not working. I just give up. Maybe you need a smaller goal to strive for first.
Does it help to have a partner who's on your side?
Absolutely.
I think so.
Yeah, that helps a lot.
Yeah. And what if, so what if you don't? I know there's some, I remember going to a counselor where it was a group counseling session where people were given each other's phone numbers and they would ring the phone from time to time to remind them of whatever it was they were supposed to be doing. Does that work?
It does work, actually. It's funny because the thing is that we have to remember we're just used to like waking up and doing what we do every day.
Yeah.
And so sometimes we have to have a reminder that we're changing a habit. So if it's writing a post-it note and putting it on your mirror every morning or setting an alarm that reminds you, that's important because we're just used to doing what we're doing.
And to be realistic, how much time should you set aside to correct a bad habit?
I think you will start to get comfortable with the new habit after 3 to 4 weeks. It doesn't mean it's going to be perfect.
Ask Ali. Ali Sokolow, sponsored by Pro Club, the Northwest Premier Center for Health and Wellness. Ali, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthwest.com.